Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome. How are you?
Good.
Speechless. Tired, sort of, weary, sort of. Not. You mean aside from the fact that my knees are killing me and my back hurts? Okay. Good enough, huh? Would somebody toss me an extra cushion? Can I put my hands on? Thank you. Two of those would work. Perfect. Thanks. All right. You all know that I collect scraps. I'm such a magpie, and probably all of us are some that way. And a couple of them that I'm just going to toss in at the beginning because are these two. And this first one is a snippet from Leonard Cohen's Anthem, but this particular snippet really caught me. Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee, right? You remember hearing that line? Mm-hmm. Every heart to life will come, to love will come, but like a refugee. And it seemed to me to sort of have the energy that was coming into the retreat, that we would come to love, but like refugees, you know, we have to get humbled before we recognize what it is, and we'll go for it in spite of all. The second one is, even in failure, an elegant performance. Yeah, that's a comment from one of our koans. Even in failure, an elegant performance. And I thought that might be a nice one to help us smile at our meditation. And take a little bit the edge off of that constant commentary that tells us we're failing all the time. And actually the name for the retreat, which surfaced very late, was just a volunteer to Refuge in Golden Wind. And it seems to be sticking, for me at least. And sometimes I collect stories, and this week we have some stories. And these first couple ones are very familiar to you, but I wanted to visit them. And first, by way of setting the stage, this week where we're already deep in retreat, where everything is meditation. Everything is meditation, and meditation is attention, is love, which says, welcome, welcome. Whether I like you or not, I don't know yet. Sometimes I spend all the time trying to figure that out. How silly is that? So I think I'll give that up for a bit and try absorption. I'll listen without first interrupting. Since the other way seems to lead to misery and destruction. everything we know, inward and outward, crumbles and falls. And so, here, in the ongoingness is where I'll take my refuge. So that's what tied me back to our Golden Wind koan, which is not where we're going to spend most of our time this evening, but it's sort of where we're beginning, when the tree withers and leaves fall. What is happening? Body exposed in golden wind. To me, that's the essence of listening without first interrupting. Body exposed in golden wind. Because while you are just made up of listening, at that moment, you have no, you're not defending, yeah? And the nature of not defending is to be completely exposed. Exposed so much that there's no inside or outside. There's only listening. What a relief. So here's the thing. All of our ancestors, human and not, seen or unseen, good seeming or evil seeming, they all have made this particular life possible. Because you, just as you are, how many zillion times have you heard me say this? And this, just as it is, requires everything that came before. Although we can't put our arms around that, it's so. We can recognize that it's so. And if we are listening, in a way, this is another form of listening, without first interrupting, then I think we can consider the possibility that they, all the beings that we can call ancestors, have offered up their mistakes trying to make a good life, and their wisdom trying to make our life good. So this brings me to what I want to hang out with you this week. The Lankavatara Sutra keeps coming back to me as a really important, foundational, helpful teaching for us. And as I understand it, among other things, it says, in interesting language, we are anointed on our foreheads by the ancestors. That's such an intimate thing. That's such a tender thing. What about the awful ancestors? You know? What about all the wars and all the slavery and all the abuses and all the environmental destruction? And yet, there is this tenderness of having received a blessing of sorts from the ancestors that seems very real to me. And our ancestors in Zen and in Buddhism, wayfarers like us, from them we can feel, we can hear in their words that blessing. We can feel their sometimes fierce and sometimes tender encouragement for us. If we wish to, we can receive that blessing. So that's number one. Number two is that our vows have great power. We don't have to understand it, but we can experience it. And that power is not sort of theoretical, it's actual. It's energy. It's skillful means. It's encouragement. It's links. It's connectedness. I'm sure that some of you know, just sort of on the most pragmatic level, that one of the most effective healing approaches for addiction is to volunteer, right? Is to do service. That's a vow. It's a vow in action. It's not a like theoretical vow. It's like, okay, tonight I'm cooking dinner. You know, tomorrow I'm collecting clothes. There's power in it for us. And for us to sit on a cushion and say, here I am, is a vow that has power. That is palpable in this room when I walk into it. So, number one, we're anointed on our foreheads by ancestors. The tall trees outside, the little buggies in the ground who are made of how many lives and stardust like us. Our vows have power. Number three, and this is in the language of the Lankavatara, anointed, and there's really a causal, there's a feeling of because, right? Because we are blessed in this way by the lives and the teachings of our ancestors, and because our vows have power, we can abandon the habit energy of beginningless projection.
Of what?
Beginningless projection. The habit energy of beginningless projection. You know, when we recite purification and we say, I vow to set endless heartache to rest. Yeah? That habit energy that we keep feeding, that brings us heartache because we keep believing that things are real and separate and we can control them, right? Starting with just glass. You know, if I want to insist on the reality of a glass, that's already using and feeding the habit energy of projection. So projection meaning we're just going to be in relationship with our pictures all the time. The constant movie screen in front of our faces. So that third piece says we can abandon the habit energy that perpetuates our addiction to screens. Okay, and then where does that go? That when we do, as we do, in the moment when we, right? This is not some sort of final accomplishment, attainment. In the moment that we do that, we step forward on the bare ground to meet the wave that rises to meet us. Yeah? When we abandon that habit energy that keeps our projection, this is sort of like the old projector going, we then just step forward naturally. It's what is, while everything else is stepping forward with us, yeah? For the taking part in the gathering. This is the gathering, yeah? This, moment by moment by moment. So, these are the things I want to talk about this week. Because to me, this is sort of the spelling out of when the tree withers and the leaves fall, golden wind. So that's the shorthand. This is the longhand. Okay. So I'll be bringing in koans that speak to those four points. So, tonight's story is about our dear ancestor Yoshihime, the devil girl. A story that's familiar to many of you from Kamakura, Japan. She was very strong, apparently. And so I'm going to read you the story from the version that's in the Hidden Lamp, because I like the way it's put. Okay? Story time. Yoshihime was a nun at Tokeji, and the daughter of a general. She was very strong, and her nickname was Devil Girl. So I never earned a nickname like that. You should get such a good nickname in my next lifetime. She wanted to meet with the teacher at the monastery of Enkakuji, but the gatekeeper monk barred her way with a shout. "What is it? The gate through which the Buddhas come into the world." She grabbed his head and forced it between her legs and said, "Look, look." The monk said, "In the middle, there's a fragrance of wind and dew." Fail. Yoshihime said, "This monk, he's not fit to keep the gate. He ought to be working in the garden." There's the gatekeeper still trying to stand up, probably. Gatekeeper ran into the temple and reported this to the teacher's attendant, who said, "Let me test her." So the attendant went to the gate and asked her again, "What is it, the gate through which the Buddhas come into the world?" And Yoshihime grabbed his head and held it between her legs, saying, "Look, look." The attendant said, "The Buddhas of the three worlds come, giving light." Yoshihime said, "This monk is one with the eye. He saw the 84,000 gates all thrown open." So who's judging who here? Okay, so that's the story. And now I want to just hang with it for a little while. So first of all, here she is at the gate. A great place to begin. I was going to talk a little bit about our hanging there, which I call Gate World, because it has characters in the corners, and somebody told me that two of the characters are Gate and World. And it's so much... is Gate World to me. The whole world is gates, and there she is, right at them and in them and looking through and being. I think she's listening without first interrupting, don't you? So there she is at the gate, and she seems pretty desperate to get in to me. That's the way I read her. She is determined to get in there. She has a question that matters. And so we have questions that matter right now. You know, we wake up, and within, I don't know, a second or two, there are big questions. There are important questions. Our hearts are broken. Our minds are overwhelmed. We don't know what we are to do. And how could it be this way? And what could be done? And what am I? And when we get underneath those questions, then the even deeper questions get there. What is this? You know? So this part also, this young woman at the gate, so much reminds me also of the parts of us that want in. The part of me that gets considered not important enough. Yeah? Not important enough. Or maybe just not good enough. Yeah? But that's where the questions are, isn't it? In the parts of us that we think aren't good enough. You know, that's where, those parts of us are often the holders of the real questions. Yeah? And are there at the gate. That must be included or we aren't complete. So that's the first thing. The second thing, so the monk challenges. What's the gate? What is it, the gate, through which all the Buddhas enter? An interesting question for a gatekeeper to ask, isn't it? I kind of love the humor of it, that, you know, he's sort of like us. It's like, I'm guarding the gate, but I have no idea what a gate is. Why exactly am I guarding this gate? You know, 3 square meals a day, you know. And so, what is it, this gate? And we, you know, we sing the vow, some of us every day, most of us every week, you know. I vow to walk through every wisdom gate, or the older translation that said, Dharma gates are countless, I vow to wake to them. Okay, fine. Well, show me one, right? So he's like, what is it? But to him, he's presenting this as the big test. But I can't help thinking, he probably wants to know. He's like, I'll ask her and then she'll tell me. And then I'll know.
That'll do it.
Yeah, or she won't, and then I'll feel so much better because she doesn't know either. And I can throw her out. So there it is. What is it? And you can, she's not thinking about this, right? This is not something that she's going, well, I wonder, what is the, you know. That's not what's happening with this girl. She is taking matters into her own hands. She's doing show me with a vengeance. And what she does is really interesting, I think. Because she's not telling him about it. She's humiliating him, isn't she? She is bringing him down. And some of you remember what Joan wrote about humiliation when she was in the three-part response to...
Myth, word, and life.
Yeah. That... This is partly our humiliation, as in humus, right? Earth. She brings him down to earth and gives him a good whiff. And I think our unclaimed parts will do that for us too, right? Every so often, the parts of us that we try to keep out of the inner courts will bring us down and help us have a look. Look, look, is all she says. Yeah? So, in a way, even before she gets him between her legs, humiliation is the gate also, yeah? When the tree withers and the leaves fall. Or, you know, in the words of the immortal Janis Joplin, you know, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. So there's that. And then, on top of that, it's true. And that's the beauty of it. And so, not only is it literally true that every single one of us enters the world through that gate, but it's so much as a gate. You know, it's closed most of the time, pretty tiny. And when a baby's coming, you're measuring the effacement of the gate. Isn't that an interesting word? It effaces itself. And by virtue of a big old muscle that we don't really control, you know? And so first there's no gate, and then there's a gate. Just like all of our awakenings. Closed until it's not. And it's dangerous. Yeah? And we don't consciously, at least, I think most of us don't consciously remember our birth, but something in us sure does remember. Remember being in, and unless we were born by C-section, being squeezed out through a tight gate. So there's that also, that sense of that coming through the gate is not necessarily voluntary. So, you know, all the Buddhas of the world pass through this gate. Yeah. And did they do it by their brilliance? Do we need to do it by our brilliance? No. No, we don't. And then, in the Buddhist tradition, actually, and I've just been coming across this, shoot, I meant to get the quote out for you. But in the Buddhist tradition, the cervix represents the mandala of emptiness and suchness that resolves dualities. So both emptiness and suchness right there. And I think there's something that seems so real about that, that something that's in the dark mostly, and unknown and unnoticed. And sort of magical in its power, has this very specific physicality to it that is essential to life for us. And one of the reasons that we that image of the red thread is so powerful for us, that there's a connection there. But birth is dangerous, right? Literally dangerous to mothers and babies. They die. And awakening is dangerous. Something dies. And so the mandala is known as an image of also of the charnel ground.
Say that again.
The mandala is also known as an image of the charnel ground. So both the body of awakening and the charnel ground. So here's this powerful meeting place of the realities of living and dying. So he gave a kind of classic form and emptiness, wind and dew, form and emptiness. She's not buying it, right? It tastes like cardboard, that kind of language, when it has nothing behind it. But the second guy, the monk's attendant, the teacher's attendant, sees the Buddhas of the three worlds come, all the worlds, giving light. The name of the temple, apparently, in Gakuji, means, the name of the great hall at Engakuji means great light hall. So he was also sort of bringing that in. So there is entering on so many levels. So, to come back to where we started, if this is sort of part one of our learning from the Lankavatara, something to hold, kind of, I hold it as a talisman. You know, I hold it as, yes, this is something true that I can live by in some ways. So you have to watch out for things like that, but when you hold something in your heart, it can have, that has power too. So here, when I said we are anointed on our foreheads by ancestors, she's one of them. She's there, you know, she's there in our sacred story collection, saying, this is what it looks like. Just a girl who wanted to get in the gate enough and could respond with what she so much knew to be true that it wasn't that kind of knowing in words. It was just this. We have that in us. And I think the way I understand the anointing is that it's a kind of a blessing that is just, yeah, this is yours. This was always yours, you know. Use it well. And go beyond. Use it now for others. So